Let's chant this again together for my sake.
Om Abhyayantu Mamangani Vak Pranas Chakshushrotramato Palindriyani Chasarvani Sarvam Brahma Upanishadam Maham Brahma Nirakuryam Mama Brahma Nirakarot Anirakaramastvayakarname astu Tadatmanirateya upanishatsudharmaste mai santu Te mai santu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
I happen to have a copy of Swamiji's book. You all, but most of you don't have that copy yet. Even if you end up not getting it until after the course, you can get it on the. If you have an iPad or something, you can get it for like $3.50 or something on Swamiji's site. So I would really suggest getting it if you can. And if you can't get it or we don't get it in time, then I would like to make sure that you order it and you get your own copy and you can study it after that course. So let me tell you how I'm proceeding and teaching this Kena Upanishad. The Kena is the first Upanishad that Swamiji teaches. He usually teaches it usually after Tattva Bodha. And he might have a Prakarana Granta in the middle like Atma Bodha or something else. But it comes very closely after Tattva Bodha. He usually, when he teaches the Kena, he doesn't teach the Bhasha. He just unfolds the Upanishad. Now, in Swamiji's talks, at least to some of us, probably all of us, his people have been through courses with him, that he is very careful that in the teaching of a 3-year course, he doesn't say everything at once. You know, I tend to say everything at once. But he's very, very meticulous about spreading this knowledge out over a 3-year period. And he really has a mind that can do that also, can hold everything and remember everything that he said and what needs to be said. It's, you know, it is what it is. Something wonderful and amazing. So, but I have been through a few of these 3-year courses. And how I see in terms of Swamiji's teaching style is that now in the Kena Upanishad, he's introducing certain things. And then later he will build on those things, introduce more things in the next Upanishad, the next Prakarana Granthas, very systematically. But when he introduces something, is talking about something, he's quite thorough about it. And so what I'm doing, in addition to just the regular reading, the regular commentaries, I'm really studying Swamiji's commentary, including his introduction, because I want to highlight everything that he's highlighting. Because they're all very... He's highlighting things that, as Vedanta teachers, these are things and prakriyas and whatnot that you really want to have an understanding of. And then you'll end up saying these things in your own order. But it's nice to just systematically go through everything step by step. And so I want to do that. And why I'm even telling you all of this is because I know that some of it may seem repetitive to you, but I don't want you to let that matter. If you've heard it before, you've heard it 100 times before, it doesn't matter. You can hear it many, many, many times again. And every time actually you hear something or you hear a different prakriya, or understand something about the Vedas or what it means for something to be a pramana, it is always going to go into your new buddhi that you have, to the amount of knowledge you have now, and it will connect in many different ways. And so these things are important for really understanding what the Vedas are, how they view themselves, what the Upanishads are, what it means for something to be a pramana, why the pramanas that we have available to us, all of which are based on sense perception, you know, are quite different than what we need in terms of gaining self-knowledge, since the self isn't an object of sense perception, you know, or any of the other pramanas that are based upon sense perception. So these things have to be really clearly understood, and so I'm just going to go ahead and say them over and over. as they come up, or as Swamiji and his, extraordinary, in my opinion, extraordinary commentary on the Kano Upanishad. It is so good. And so I want to make sure that all of his points are unfolded, that he decides to bring up. I mean, you can bring up so many different points in any given verse or in the introduction. So many ways you can do it. But I want to do it in the way that he did it. And so then when you go back and hopefully really study it on your own, when you get your text, it'll be a really good, very wonderful experience for you. It's just such an extraordinary commentary. I think one of the reasons it's some of Swamiji's now commentaries are so well done in book form, which is not easy. You know, usually like a class, when you transcribe a class, it can be like 50 pages for hour and a half class. And you're not going to want to read 50. It has to be edited. And for most of these books, Swami Sakshat Kritananda was the editor. And I used to sit in classes when he was there. He'd be sitting on the side wall. And Swamiji, Pooja Swamiji used to do this also. He would just be typing exactly. He'd type it all as Swamiji was saying it. So he didn't have to do it again. He just sat there like this. Swamiji used to do this with Pooja Swamiji also, because he was such a fast typer, he could keep up with it. And then go and edit it. So Sakshat did that. And Sakshat also is an extraordinarily wonderful teacher. And I could take another course from him. I think so much of him. And he has such a deep grasp of this knowledge. It's just very moving. His meditations used to just unbelievable. So simple, so direct, no nonsense, boom, there it is. He did it so beautifully. So his understanding of Swamiji is so much. And he's the one that has done most of the editing for Swamiji's books. So I think that's why when I just read it, my heart just opens. I just, like, it is a amazing. So I want to try to do my best to kind of honor what Swamiji's introduction and some interesting Sanskrit that he brings out in each verse, and make sure that we have an understanding of that. And then you can enjoy reading the book when you get it. So, Swamiji's introduction to the Kano Upanishad is a lengthy introduction. And I think it's so lengthy and is what it is because in the 3-year courses, this is the first Upanishad that he teaches. And so that fact lends itself, and it's often the first Upanishad that's taught. I'll talk about that later. But that lends itself to wanting to talk a little bit about the Vedas themselves, the Vedas and the Vedanta, you know, the Upanishads, and to understand how they fit in to the scheme of things in terms of pramanas, being a pramana. And what that means for the Vedas and the Vedanta to be viewed as a pramana, what exactly a pramana is, you know, technically as we unfold it. And so that's a lot of what he covers in his first intro. So I thought that I would just talk to you a little bit about that. From the traditional, I say traditional because if you go to academics, like I have to be at the university, and this is an academic place, though they hire people who are committed to giving traditions to try to get around that academic slant. So the academic slant would be kind of an intellectual viewing of what the Hindus say about the Upanishads, whereas for somebody who is within the tradition, it's, you know, these are what the Upanishads are. You know, these are what the Vedas are. And for them, for like somebody who's held within the Vedic tradition, they being held in that, they have a certain shraddha, a certain understanding of the Vedas, and having shraddha, they accept the Vedas as being such. So the whole Vedas are looked upon as a pramana, a means of knowledge. That's how they view themselves, as a means of knowledge. The first part of the Vedas, there's two parts. The first part of the Vedas is called the Karmakanda. And the Karmakanda is, if I say the whole Vedas, if I put them all together, the one Veda would be about this thick. And this much would be the Karmakanda. And this much would be the Vedanta. The Vedanta is that which comes at the end, in terms of placement, at the end of the Vedas. Right? So you've got the Karmakanda, the main body of the Vedas, followed by the Advaita Vedanta, the Upanishads, which are the second part, called the Jnanakanda. Kanda means the section, the section that deals with karma, the section that deals with karma and rituals and dharma and the transmigration of the jiva and the different lokas, the different worlds. So, and what is the dharma depending upon your stage of life? So Swamiji used to call this first part like a handbook, you know, a handbook for you, telling you what to do and what not to do. What is punya? What is papa? What are your duties? What is the layout of the creation? What happens to you when you die? What is punya, papa? All of these things, it goes in great detail. And it also tells you all of the different rituals that are necessary for you to do on a daily basis, or called nitya karmas, or rituals that are necessary for you to do on an occasional basis, called naimittika karmas. Kamya karmas are rituals that you can do when you have a desire but are having trouble fulfilling that desire. I told you the story about the student who so badly wanted a child. And so they had rituals done in order for that to take place. And then they got the child. It's called Putra Kameshti. And so they're Kamya karmas, right? And then there's karmas that are not to be done. Patishuddha karmas, things not to be done. Things to avoid, things, types of being or types of activity not to do. They bring about papa. So the first, Swami says, it's like a manual, a handbook for how to live in this creation, and kind of a guidebook, like how to have the maximum amount of happiness in this creation, and what are the rules? Okay. What is heaven? What is hell? What is transmigration? How does all of this work? What is punya and papa? All of these things are dealt with in the first part of the Vedas. In the second part of the Vedas, which is so thin, it's for a different adhikari. The first part is for the adhikari. Adhikari means the person qualified for it, is a person who themselves is held within the Vedic vision. Or for concluding all of us, it would be held within dharma. Those who are held within dharma, you know. And what is the means for the highest degree of happiness within a relative world? That's the first. So it's a handbook, it's a manual. What to do, what not to do. You know, what to expect, what happens to you when you die. All of these questions we all want to know. What are the heaven worlds? What are the hell worlds? What is the highest heaven world? How do you get there? All of these things. It's a manual, you know, for the samsari. By samsari, we mean the jiva who is not yet a mumukshu and is still trying to create a happy life through dharma, always, and through the fulfillment of desires. And how to get to heaven worlds, where my lifespan is much longer. How to do all of these things in order to have the maximum amount of shanti, the maximum amount of peace that I can have in this world. That's samsara. But it's the samsara of a dharmanishta, you know, somebody who's held within the Vedic vision. For the Upanishads, which come at the end of the Vedas, why I'm stressing this is because in the Brahma Sutras, this question came up. What do they mean by Veda Anta, Vedanta? Anta means the end. So some schools will translate Vedanta as kind of the end knowledge, the final knowledge of the Vedas. What is the final end message that the Vedas have to give? That is held in the Upanishads. In the Brahma Sutras, no, that is not the meaning. It's very simple. The Karmakanda comes first, the first portion of Vedas, and then the second portion of the Vedas comes after it. At the end of the Vedas is where the Upanishads are physically located. So when you say Vedanta, we just want to say where the Vedanta comes, the Upanishads are located at the end of the Vedas. That's what it is. The Vedanta, called the Upanishads, is really comprised of the Upanishads, have not to do with how to have the maximum happiness in the world, but it has to do with knowing who I am and what is the world. Who am I? Who is God? What is God? And what is this creation? You know? What is moksha, that's all common knowledge in the Hindu, in the Vedic context? What is moksha? What is liberation? What about me that survives death? Who am I? It's the who am I question. And who am I in relationship to the world and in relationship to God? Who, and to this body, mind, sense organs, who am I? That's the Vedas. And so it has this question to answer. And so it doesn't take, you know, thousands of pages to do that. Because it isn't a collection of like innumerable rituals and innumerable advices about what you need to do in certain situations and like that. So these Vedas, which are considered within the tradition, there's three things you need to know about them, besides whatever else we say. Okay. One is that the Vedas are considered what we call apaurusheyam. Purusha means a person. Apaurusheyam means it's not man-made. It's not something that comes out of somebody's mind. It is divine. It is something that comes from the, as though the mouth is the, like the breath of Ishwara. It comes from Ishwara directly, and it is nityam. So we would call that in English, we'd call it revealed knowledge. The Vedas are viewed within the tradition as revealed knowledge, and they are nityam, beginningless. They come with the creation. And they are viewed as a pramana, as a means of knowledge. So apaurusheyam, revealed knowledge. We can say like this, a revealed means of knowledge, which is a little different than just revealed knowledge. It's revealed knowledge. It's nityam, means it's something that is beginningless, comes along with there. You could say instead of nityam, it's probably better to say anadi, beginningless. Say anadi, beginningless. And it is a pramana. It's a means of knowledge. Okay. So then the question comes in, of course, what is really a means of knowledge? What makes a means of knowledge a means of knowledge? What are the qualities of something being a means of knowledge? So the first thing is to understand the context of this word pramana. Means of knowledge, pramana. A means of knowledge requires a pramatra. Pramatra, so we've got this prama, right? So pramatra means the one who utilizes the means of knowledge, which would be the knower, okay? So the pramatra is the knower, the pramana is the means of knowledge, and the prameya is the object of knowledge. So this is very, but this just to give you the Sanskrit. So you have the pramatra, the one who is the knower that utilizes the pramana, the means of knowledge, which gives knowledge of the prameya, the object of knowledge. Okay, so we've got this trinity, tripudi it's called. So now what this means is that for there to be a pramana, a means of knowledge, two other things are required, right? You need somebody utilizing that means of knowledge, the pramatra, the knower, and then you need an object of knowledge. Okay. Now the Vedas call themselves a pramana for knowing something very specific. So now I want to go back to another definition of understanding pramana a little bit more than just a means of knowledge. A pramana is what makes it a means of knowledge is that it gives a knowledge that nothing else can give. And so cannot be really negated by another means of knowledge, because the other means of knowledge doesn't have the same, what we call vishya, the same scope as one given pramana. So say for instance, just to give an example, say for instance within pratyaksha, if you remember, pratyaksha means the direct immediate knowledge that we gain through sense perception, right? So say using my eyes, I am able through the sense perception, through my eyes, to gain the prameya, the means of the object of knowledge, which would be color. Sometimes we say form, but form can be felt by the sense of touch. So we say color. So now what other of the pramanas available to me can give me the knowledge or the experience of color? Your ears can't, right? Your sense of touch can't. And so each one, in terms of pratyaksha, each one of these five sense organs, which what they have in common is that they give direct, immediate knowledge, but the knowledge that they give can't be replaced, you know, or contradicted even by another pramana, because the other pramana gives something totally different. Okay? Cannot see color. And eyes can't hear sound. So the word for this that we use is called anadigata. Means it's not known before. Without the operation of this given pramana, this particular knowledge is not available to us, right? So even say if you take something like we had the pratyaksha sense perception, and then we had all of the other actually five means of knowledge that are dependent on sense perception. Sense perception is the primary means of knowledge for how we get along in this world, how we know what we know. So say, for instance, I have the pratyaksha sense perception, and then I have anumana that we call inference. Inference depends upon sense perception, right? So if I see smoke, that's pratyaksha. I can infer fire, because there's what we call an avyapti, an invariable concomitance from between smoke and fire. And so if I can see the smoke, I can infer the fire. But seeing the smoke is not enough. Then I'm just seeing smoke. That pratyaksha has done its job. It's over, you know. For me to be able to say that there is fire on the hill, I need to have understood that invariable relationship between smoke and fire. And if that fire is correct, if the smoke is correct, I'm really seeing smoke and not a cloud or fog or something, then that is an invariable relationship, and so I can know, I can actually have knowledge of fire. And so the important part here is this word anadigata, means it hasn't been gained, the knowledge hasn't been gained, whatever, by any other pramana, what this particular knowledge can give. Like say if I go to our next one, our tapati, which is like an extension in a sense of anumana, an extension of inference. It's still not inference, it's different. It depends upon sense perception and something else. But in this case, with the arthopathy, it's called presumption. Like by the stock example, as I look outside in the morning, the sun is shining and there are puddles all over. So I can very legitimately presume that it rained last night. Why can I presume that? It's because there is nothing known to anyone that could cause that other than rain. It's not just one little puddle. Like say if you left your hose on or something, and so it flooded an area. This is not that. When it's covered with water, covered with puddles all over the place, there's only one thing that can cause that. And there has to be only one thing that can cause it in order for that presumption to be valid. And so then without a doubt, you say it rained last night. It must have rained last night. Right? So you have a means of knowledge that the inference can't do because the two are not happening at the same time. There's different things involved. And just the same perception alone can't do. So now, just not to go through, we've been through all of these, but just to say this, that when we're talking about a means of knowledge, each means of knowledge has a very peculiar, specific vishya. Vishya means scope. Yeah. It can do something which the other means of knowledge cannot do. It can give you knowledge which the other means of knowledge cannot do. Okay? This is one of the main definitions of something being a pramana. Otherwise, that particular perception or whatever will be included into one of the pramanas. So the six pramanas that we have available, you know, all of them, six, yeah, okay. The ones that we have, the pramanas that we have available, you know, cannot fit into another means of knowledge because they do something that the other means of knowledge cannot do. They can give knowledge that the other means of knowledge cannot give. Okay. So if we look at, say we have pratyeksha, which means sense perception, and all of these other, I'll just list them for you and translate them. The first one we said was anumana, that's inference, smoke, fire. Then we said, you know, artapati, presumption. It rained last night. Okay. Then there's another one called upamana, where somebody tells you that, Swamiji's example is that somebody tells you that a bison looks like a cow, similar to a cow, you know. And so then when you see a bison, you can say, oh, that must be a bison. You didn't know, wouldn't have known it, or even to look with like that. It's a little bit more complicated, but that's basically like, it's called similarity. Somebody can explain that there is such a thing in the forest, it looks like my cow, you know, we call it a bison. So then you're walking around the forest and you see that and say, oh, that must be a bison. Okay, so this is called similarity. So that's the third one, upamana. The fourth one is anupalabdhi. Anupalabdhi means non-cognition, right? Non-cognition. Non-cognition means, you know, there's no elephant sitting in the middle of the room. We can't see that there's no elephant in the room because we can only see forms. We can only see color. So something else is necessary. And that which is necessary cannot be given by any of the other pramanas. Okay. So again, all of these are unadigata. They are unknown, cannot be known by the other pramanas. Say now we go to Shabda Pramana. The Shabda Pramana is a pramana that really, through the use of words, you can gain indirect knowledge. Right? And so here in this realm of what were indirect and direct knowledge, actually, Shabda means sentences, you know, what we can know through words. All of our education is really, for the most part, from indirect knowledge. We need pratyeksha because we need to be able to read. We need to be able to listen, you know, in order to gain this, in order to be able to understand the words. But the words, we're standing on the knowledge we gain from books all of the time. That's what our education is primarily from Shabda Pramana. So these are our basic pramanas, pratyeksha, anumana, artapati, anupalabdhi, right? If I done all, upamana, and shabda. That's six, okay? Shabda pramana. All of them, there's two qualifications. All of them have to be anadigata. Anadigata means we can't gain that knowledge through any other means, any other pramana. They're unique. And the other one, they have to be palavat. They have to have some fruit, some result from using them. You know, they have to hand over the goods of some sort. Otherwise, what are they? Hey, you're using this pramana, but nothing comes of it at all. Now that's a useless thing. So every means of knowledge has to be unique unto itself, and giving something that any of the other means of knowledge cannot give. And there has to be a result that comes from the utilization of that means of knowledge. Okay? So these two things are really important. So now we have these five and even six using shabda. When we use shabda, we can say, even in reference to the world, we use shabda pramana, especially for indirect knowledge, you know, like reading textbooks and asking for directions and this kind of stuff. We have the shabda pramana that takes place through words. We also have examples in the world of indirect knowledge, like the Soyam Devadattaha. That boy named Devadatta, you know, in third grade, our good friend, that's this 50-year-old here standing right in front of you. That Devadatta who was there in Chennai is this Devadatta now, 50 years later, standing right in front of you here in Mumbai. Okay. That brings together... even though I saw this, I remember this guy, I'm seeing this guy standing here, but something has to bring these two together. It's called Bhagatyaga Lakshana. It's very similar, this example is very similar to what we use in the Upanishads. I have to drop off the little boy, you know, who is living in Chennai, and drop off the older man who is here in Mumbai with us now. Those have to drop off. And I have to recognize this Devadatta, who is the same, that boy is this as this man. Right? Even though that boy doesn't look like this man very much, Swamiji will go like this, squinting. Ah, yeah, you are Devadatta. Yeah. He brings the two together. So young, that Devadatta is this Devadatta. So that brings about a type of direct knowledge. Right? So the Shabda Pramana we have in the world also, but when we're using the darshana system, say you're learning the darshanas are the different philosophical systems that are there in India. Okay, so they're called darshanas among the academics, and even within the Vedanta and within the Brahma Sutras, they're known as darshanas. But the word darshana means seeing. Comes from the root drish, to see. So in India, the darshanas are interested only in moksha. They're interested not in having an intellectual understanding of the truth. They want to have direct, immediate recognition, knowledge of the true nature of reality, which for all of them, in terms of the astikas, those who accept the Vedas as a pramana, they want all to have the knowledge of the truth, which is moksha. It's not just for Advaita Vedanta that knowledge of the reality is moksha. They all have that. Knowledge of reality is moksha. And moksha is at the very least the total elimination of suffering. And for most of the darshanas, moksha is the elimination and the negative of suffering and the... and also the gain of ananda. In other words, that's a way of saying not the gain of ananda as though a new experience, but the recognition that the nature of reality, in this case for us, Brahman, the nature of Brahman, in Brahman, the non-dual Brahman, which is your own being, that your own nature is really the source of all ananda, of all types of joy experienced in the world, is because of your nature reflected in those the types of vrittis that you have. So that's something that's accepted by all of the darshanas. So what's important in terms of these darshanas around the Shabda Pramana is that the astikas, those who accept the Vedas as a pramana. all of the Astikas accept the Vedas as a pramana. The Gnostics, and that pramana is Shabda. They all accept the Vedas as being a Shabda pramana. If they accept the Vedas as a Shabda pramana, a means of knowledge that takes place through the handling of words, then they are called Astikas. If they don't accept the Vedas as a pramana, they are called Gnostikas. They don't rely on the Vedas at all. Now, Swamiji mentioned in his intro that this is really it's interesting because the philosophical systems, if I can call them like that, like the Sankhya Yoga and the Mimamsa and the Vaisheshikas all and the Bauddha, what they accept as a pramana actually limits what they can talk about. If, for instance, if you're a Gnostica and you don't accept the Vedas as a pramana, you really can't say or care about the different lokas, about Punyanpapa, in terms of something that is Vedic, reincarnation, or all of these kind of things. They're just outside of the scope of your scope. Even the cyclical nature of the creation, outside of the scope. Because you yourself, with your means of knowledge, you can't have those experiences. Right? So I used the example once that for the Bauddha, they do accept karma and reincarnation, but that's only because the Buddha himself had some sort of a spiritual experience on a different loka, different astral traveling or whatever it is, on a different loka, that allowed him to see and experience that process of the reincarnation of the jivas. And so when he came back from that experience, he talked about it and told what it was and what he had seen. And because his students had Shraddha in him, they accepted what he said. It's called as an apta purusha. An apta purusha means a qualified person that is worthy of that Shraddha. Okay, so when the Vedas say the Vedas are themselves a means of knowledge, what they're saying is that the means of knowledge which they are is called Shabda Pramana. Now what I just said a little bit ago, that Shabda Pramana we have in the relative world also, right? But when we're talking philosophically within the Darshana system, if you accept Shabda Pramana, you're accepting the Vedas. What it really means in the discussion is that you accept the Vedas as a Pramana. If you don't accept Shabda Pramana, it means, even though it has a wider application, what it means is you don't accept the Vedas as a Pramana. So you become a Gnostica. The Astikas accept the Shabda Pramana, and the Vedas are, and they're talking about in reference to the Vedas. So that's an important thing to know. And so the Vedas accept themselves as Shabda Pramana means this. So then now there's some implication, so we have to understand. Means this. I'm almost forgetting what I'm going to say, but not quite. I'm hoping I can catch it before it leaves me. Okay. Okay, so wait a minute. Okay, so the Vedas accepting themselves as Shabda Pramana, they accept in this way. The first portion of the Vedas, it's called the Mimamsa or the Karmakanda. When they present themselves as a Shabda Pramana, which means that it can give knowledge that none of the other Pramanas can give, and that it has a pala, that you gain something from that knowledge, these two things. But the type of Shabda Pramana is indirect knowledge. It's indirect because the knower still remains, right? And the knower now has to have an indirect knowledge of heaven or of the deities like Vayu and Indra and Ganesha, you know, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, all of these things, Punya, Papa. There is an indirect knowledge which, if you're within the Vedic myth container, you have Shraddha in the Vedas, and so you accept what they say. Without Shraddha, you know, it's just somebody's scripture, and this is what that scripture says, but for you, it's not, you don't think of it as the truth or as not the truth, you don't really think about it. It's not your scripture. You don't have Shraddha in it. So it's not speaking the truth to you. And so you it's nearly not. For you, it is not functioning as a Shabda Pramana, giving indirect knowledge. Okay? So now one thing to understand, too, about this indirect knowledge, you are learning from the Vedas something that you can't know on your own with your own sense organs. You can't see heaven. You can't see Punya and Papa and all of the different lokas and all of the worlds. You can't experience the manifestation and dissolution of the creation. You don't know all of these gods, where they live, what they do. All of these things, you know, are not something that you have a means of knowledge, even if you take into account inference and presumption, you know, and upamana. All the means of knowledge that we have available to us can't give us this knowledge. Okay. And so when the Vedas say that they are a pramana, they're saying what we have to tell you cannot be gained by any other pramana. That's what makes us a pramana. Okay. But a pramana like this, which is telling you something that you have no means of knowledge, you know, no other means of knowledge to get to, like when you're using Shabda, somebody's telling you about some beautiful place in China they went to. You're taking that on faith, but you can go check that out, you know, and also talk to other people that have been there when it's Shabda, like that. But here, how can you check that out? Yeah. So as a revealed means of knowledge, there's an acceptance of this as a revealed means of knowledge, that it is not something that you can validate with your own means of knowledge. Right? It's indirect knowledge, so you're not going to have a direct experience of it, you know. And so, but so it's definitely anadigata, and it's also palava. It also has a pala, because by understanding dharma and adharma, by understanding the rituals, actually that gives you a lot of capacity, because the rituals tend to work, you know. And understanding dharma and adharma and that whole philosophy around dharma and adharma also gives you access to a lot more joy in life, and makes life very, simplifies life to a great extent. And you become a happier person. So what if you follow kind of the laws of the Vedas, first part of the Vedas, and you just become more and more miserable? You know, or nothing happens. You know, this is not something I don't think this works. But say, on the other hand, say you're born into a Vedic family, you have Shraddha in it, and you follow these rules. And it's also an understanding of the world, you know, that has, I would say like this, the vision of the world and what goes on in the world is emotionally satisfying to a human being, because of the sense that it makes, you know, and because of in the small ways that you are acting out dharma or doing different rituals and pujas to Bhagawan, you know, these things actually make a difference in your own well-being, you know, in your own sense of happiness. And so it gives a lot of results. But if you don't have that Shraddha, you know, it won't be something to you that you use. You need the Shraddha, because it's Shabda Pramana and it's indirect knowledge. It's not something that you can know yourself. So that's an important thing to understand about Shabda Pramana, and it's the same in the world. Like we, Swamiji, always use the example of in India asking somebody for directions. And I mean, that is really tricky. And because they all want, you know, to help you. And they want to be able to give you directions. Even though they don't know, they still want to give you the directions to help you. Or whatever it is. They don't want to not know. Yeah. And so this Aptapurusha comes in. Does the person evoke your Shraddha, your trust, you know? So this type of Shraddha necessary for indirect knowledge is even here in the world. Like, say, your professor has ordered a textbook for you to study chemistry, you know, and has, of course, talked to you about the qualifications of the authors, you know, so that you have Shraddha in the textbook. It's not just some flaky textbook that you're going to spend hours and hours, but there you can't trust what they're talking about. It's really important to know who's writing and what their qualifications are, so that you have Shraddha, you know, so that you can read those books, study those books, and have some Shraddha in what's being said there. So in terms of indirect knowledge, I mean, Shraddha is very important, even in the world, let alone in the Vedas, you know. So first portion of the Vedas is giving you knowledge, important, knowledge that you can't get through your own means of knowledge. So this will mean, just to give it just a little bit more depth, this will mean that a lot of things that are said in the Vedas are not a pramana. Like Swamiji gives the example to say they're telling you how to perform a ritual. And so say, in this particular ritual, you need to use bricks. Okay. You already know what bricks are, you know. And so they're not being a pramana for bricks. You know what bricks are. Okay. But when they say, you need 13 bricks, which are put in a square in this particular order, that is a pramana. Because that comes from the Vedas. You didn't know anything at all about how many bricks or how to put those bricks, you know. Then say it tells you, and then it tells you how to do the ritual. These particular chants need to be chanted in this order, and these particular, the ghee and various things, ghee and milk and things have to be offered. You know ghee, you know milk, you know these chants even. Of course, those chants are Vedic also, but in terms of this ritual, you had no idea, you know. You know ghee and you know milk and you know chandas and chandam and all of these things, you know. But you don't know how to offer them, how it needs to be done. That's where the pramana comes in. So a lot of the things that are said, they're just talking to you about things that you already know, but then they tell you how to use those things. That is different. And so then there becomes a lot of discussion on what's a pramana and what part is a pramana, what is not a pramana. The part that's not a pramana is the things that you can't know by yourself. Your means of knowledge can't tell you that. That's what makes it a pramana. Remember, a pramana means anadigata. Another means of knowledge can't give you that. You know? And also palava, it has a pala. You gain a result from the practice of that karma. Okay. Now, the second, so we've got the first portion of the Vedas, which gives indirect knowledge. It requires Shraddha for you to have any interest or use it as a pramana. That Shraddha has to be there. In the second part of the Vedas, the Vedanta, that also is a pramana, but it gives aparoksha jnanam. Aparoksha jnanam is direct, immediate knowledge, and the reason for that is that the knowledge is about you, and you are already here. And you, there's a couple of things, it's about yourself, and yourself as Brahman, that you, in fact, are Brahman. And so this knowledge also requires Shraddha in order to use this pramana, just to use the pramana. But the knowledge itself doesn't require Shraddha, you know? Like I might need Shraddha. Swamiji sometimes talk about the guy who thinks he's blind and doesn't want to take his blindfold off and everything so he can see. He has to have Shraddha to take his blindfold off. But, you know, if he sees, he sees. So where's the Shraddha? There. There's just knowledge taking place. And so here, the Shraddha that is necessary for the second part of the Vedas is just what allows you, we say Ishwara Anugraha, the grace of God, you know, to, for some reason, be willing or have some Shraddha in the efficacy of these, of the Vedanta, of the Upanishads. It rings true to you, you know. We can say it's a Vedanta Vasana. You picked it up, or you brought it forward from your last life. And so when you're exposed to it, you, that Shraddha is there. You want this knowledge, you know. And it's giving you a knowledge which none of the other Pramanas can give you. Because all of the other Pramanas we have available to us are based upon sense perception. And yourself is not an object of sense perception. So what can you do? Here, I want to know myself. I'm not going to be an object of sense perception. I'm, in fact, the luminary. And I am here. So we say it's not paroksha. It's not. I'm not going to gain indirect knowledge of me because here I am. You know, and it's not going to be pratyaksha or immediate knowledge through sense perception because I'm not an object to myself. So we say it's aparoksha. It's not indirect because I am here. And so the Upanishads become, are viewed as a means of knowledge for knowing the self, the nature of myself. But now, just to wind this up until the next class, there is a big difference between knowledge that I can gain of the world, even knowledge I can gain in the first part of the Vedas of the heaven worlds. Because in these knowledges, whether it be just dependent upon Shabda Pramana for indirect knowledge, or we're having direct knowledge through the means of knowledge that we have, we still have a subject-object relationship. We still have the knower who, using a pramana, knows the object of knowledge. Like this triputi is there for all of them, but not for Vedanta. This triputi goes away because the knower and the means of knowledge and the object of knowledge, right, which we usually rely on for acquiring knowledge in terms of a subject-object relationship, is going to be different now because the object of knowledge is the subject. The object, what I'm trying to know, is the subject. And that subject is the self of the pramatra. Remember, the pramatra is the knower, the pramana is the means of knowledge, and then the prameya is the object of knowledge. Here, the prameya, the object of knowledge, is the nature of the pramatra, of the knower, the self of the knower. The self of the knower cannot be an object of knowledge. I can't look at the self of the knower, right? And so what happens in this means of knowledge is that the pramatra, the knower, is resolved completely, right? Because the subject of knowledge, the object of knowledge, is the very subject of the knower itself. And so the knower has to go away. The knower resolves into the self of the knower. And that is necessary in order for the very tatparya, the essence of the Vedanta, to be realized. Because the essence of the Vedanta, the vision of the Vedanta called the tatparya, is tat tvamasi. You are that. It means you, O jiva, you are Brahman, or you are Ishvara. And for that equation to take place, the limitations of the jiva have to be dropped. And the infinite expression of Ishvara has to be dropped, Bhagatyaga Lakshana, in order for the recognition of myself as Brahman to take place. And in the recognition of myself as Brahman, as infinite conscious being, in order for that to take place, there can't be a pramatra. A pramatra is limited. you know something different than I know, and you know something different than I know, and the mosquitoes know something different than each mosquito knows and we know. There's like an infinite number of knowers, and they all know something else, and they're all limited. And so I cannot be the limited knower if the vision that's being given is that I am Brahman. I am the non-dual conscious being, the me, this me, is the one non-dual self from whom this whole creation comes. And so the way this knowledge is gained through the handling of the Upanishads is going to be different than the way, the means by which we gain knowledge of the objects in the world, either as directly or indirectly. And so that knowledge, which as we get into the third verse, especially of the Kenu Upanishad, the Kenu Upanishad, there's a discussion, it's a dialogue between the teacher and the student. And the student was going to ask a question. He asks a question. The second verse, the teacher, the guru, answers the question partially. And then in the third verse, he says something like, this is the only way we can teach this. This is how we have been taught, and this is how we're teaching you. So, because this can't be taught in a normal way. Because I'm here, and so it's going to be aparoksha, direct, immediate knowledge, but I'm the very self of the knower. And so who's going to know me? How is that going to take place? So that has to be understood. So this is most of Swamiji's unfoldment of his introduction to the Kena Upanishad. A couple more things to say about it, but we'll do in the morning. That's it.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.